This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On Tuesday night, as everyone settled in to watch the election returns, Bob and Brooke and the rest of the OTM team were getting ready for our first ever live-streamed show, which we called Imprecision 2020. Imprecision, Imprecision, Imprecision,
Imprecision 2020, Imprecision. Oh, Imprecision, election, Imprecision, data, Imprecision 2020, Imprecision, swing states, Imprecision, predictions, Imprecision, electoral college, Imprecision, Nate Silver.
Good evening. I didn't get into this business to be seen, but here we are. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
For election updates, we had a segment that repeated every 20 minutes called 2020's on the 20s. With On the Media producers Michael Loewinger.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for working for us.
And Leia Feder.
Hey, Brooke, how's it going?
Great.
Our very own John King and Steve Kornacki.
A bunch of Senate races have been called. Significant is Mitch McConnell, who won re-election in Kentucky against Amy McGrath. A lot of money was poured into that race, but all the polls had indicated that he was projected to win, so no surprises there.
Oh, wait. There's been a whole bunch more that I've just seen. Biden is now at 119 electoral votes, and Trump is at 94.
Did you just fake that?
No, not at all. This is dynamic, folks.
Our guests for the evening ranged from WNYC hosts Brian Lehrer and Kai Wright to BuzzFeed's Jane Litvinenko to Alec Baldwin to Mike Pesca to comedian Jessica Curson to, well, just so many. But there was one interview that we want to play for you in full. Here's Brooke.
Michael Denzel Smith is a writer and fellow at Type Media Center, whose most recent book is called Stakes is High: After the American Dream. It focuses on the perils for the individual and the nation of embracing the American myth, the idea that everything is possible for those who work hard. I mean, we've seen that in action in the past few years, and we've seen that no equal opportunity, no equal access to health care or education, nor even a guarantee of justice exists because our institutions were designed by those who already enjoyed such guarantees and the concomitant wealth they were unwilling to share. In Stakes is High, he writes about the insidious nature of the dream, which works its way into the heads of those who are not served by it, where it breeds despair, and into the heads of would-be liberal allies, where it fosters complacency and tunnel vision. He said that 4 years ago Tuesday, on November 8, 2016, his sense of the possible was shattered. That day, a couple of days before his 30th birthday, he broke.
Look, it took me by surprise 4 years ago. I genuinely thought the country was in a different place. Like, I didn't believe that it was in sort of this all new place in which all of the underlying issues that keep animating our politics were solved. But I did think we were in a different place than we ended up. And I think that's got me tonight, and I'm sure as many people are, just sort of on edge, stressed out, body tied up in knots, concerned about how much progress has been made and whether or not we're up against 4 more years of Donald Trump, which is 4 years that we can't afford, and 4 years that really cements something about this country. It cements the commitment to the project of white supremacy, the project of authoritarian regime. And the big thing for me that always comes to mind, and I think should be the front of mind for everyone, we simply can't afford 4 more years of Donald Trump when it comes to climate change. We're up against it. We don't have any time, really. And without massive movement on that, we're solely screwed. There's no nice way of putting it. And so it has me stressed out in a different way this time.
You wrote, "We're not immune to the indoctrination into the American myth, the promise of a free, equal, and just America in which your own destiny is completely under your control sounds wonderful. And because it hurts too much to think that your future is controlled by anything other than your own actions, it's easy to fall under this spell." You describe falling under it and then out of it all through your life.
I wrote that as someone who is professionally a critic of exactly those ideas, right? Like constantly engaged with it. But what I do find myself doing and saying and believing often are things that are still a part of that myth. You know, in the book, what I write about is sort of my relationship to New York City and thinking of New York City as this bastion of liberalness and progressive politics and arts and culture and all of these things that would feel liberating. But it's also a city that's still and has been always a gilded city, a city where extreme wealth exists next to extreme poverty. This very city that birthed Donald Trump, the city that helped his family to amass the amount of wealth that it did, the wealth that inoculates him from any consequences of his actions.
Largely by working a tax code and a legal system that benefits the rich and extracts wealth from people who aren't.
If New York City can have all of those things and right-wingers still paint it as this like socialist city, right? Like fearful of what exists here, how are we going to ever question the ideological underpinnings of the institutions that uphold the inequalities that we find here in New York? What I was trying to get at with what you read there is that I'm not immune. I'm not immune to it. And I think so many of us, especially right now, are looking toward an election of Joe Biden. There's a lot of people hoping that it's a return to normal, that it ends the aberration of Donald Trump's 4 years as president, where the country lost its way. That's the myth. The myth is believing that Donald Trump is losing the American way instead of seeing him as an outcome of the very ideologies that we have so far not uprooted. The problem with that thinking is that we can't afford to then elect Joe Biden as president and to act as if that was sufficient, to act as if all of these things that we've come to fear during the Trump presidency are then solved. No, Joe Biden has to face the kind of pressure that makes the presidents that we remember for their virtues and that we exalt. You know, there's no Abraham Lincoln if it isn't for the abolitionists who push him. There's no FDR if it isn't for the labor movements that push him. And there's no Lyndon Johnson if it isn't for the civil rights movement that pushes him. And so if we're not willing to engage again with the myth and with our own unlearning, with all of the things that we've seen and been horrified by during the Trump presidency, and ensure not only that Biden doesn't repeat those things, but is undoing a lot of what has been erected during this time and before him, then we fall into the trap in which we could see another Donald Trump in some incarnation down the road.
I want to play you a tape. It's of Obama on the campaign trail. And basically, I think it was David Sirota who said it was kind of like, you know, if this election goes right, you can go back to brunch.
And here's one other thing. Joe and Kamala, when they are in office, you're not going to have to think about them every single day. You're not going to have to worry about what crazy things they're going to say, what they're going to tweet. They're just going to be too busy doing the work. It just won't be so exhausting. You'll be able to go about your lives knowing that the president's not going to retweet conspiracy theories about secret cabals running the world.
I mean, maybe that's the case. We don't have to worry about the president retweeting conspiracy theorists, but we should be paying attention to the work that the president and vice president will be doing.
Right.
I think that that's really important for us as citizens of this country to be paying attention to the work that the president does. Like, that's the thing. If we're looking simply for a symbol, we're looking for a figurehead to project onto the idea of moral clarity as opposed to dealing with policy, right? The things that they're in charge of, the actual impact that these things have on people's lives, then sure, you can listen to Obama there. But what we need to be doing is holding their feet to the fire. I mean, one example of a thing that has already upset me is Joe Biden, when asked if he would tear down the new construction that's been erected on the border with Mexico, not even the old stuff, right? Like just that which been erected during the Trump administration, mm-hmm. He couldn't commit to doing that. And so the idea of a unengaged citizenry is anti-democratic, right? Like that, this is the whole idea of self-governance, is that we are involved. We should be talking about what they are doing every single day. I think that that desire for normalcy gets us back to a place in which presidents can go about the work of constructing the American myth, and in doing so, continue to operate along the lines of all of the oppressive ideologies that have shaped this nation. And if we're not willing to question and not willing to push and not willing to agitate, then we get back to this place at some point.
So what does that mean for the stories that people seeking real change should be telling ourselves or each other at this particular moment?
During the Obama years, there was a feeling for a lot of people in which things were just taken care of, right? There was no reason to be engaged. There weren't the sort of things that you see under Trump or even during the Bush years, where there were these sort of catastrophes that felt like they were outside the norm. And that's the problem. In order to address the problems that we actually need, the narrative has to be constructed that Donald Trump was not 4 years of an aberration, and you have to be diligently fighting against that. Because I think that in the event of a Trump win, there's an obvious boogeyman, there's an obvious evil, there's an obvious villain. The Biden win, I think, will be such a sigh of relief for so many people that they won't see a Biden presidency as an enemy that they need to engage, right? Like, it is simply restoring an adult to the position of president. They then will want to just trust that that person's doing their job.
Yeah, that's the big worry, right? And you address it in your book, the complacency of white liberals who hold all the right positions, but who don't put skin in the game.
No, exactly. That's exactly that. And so the narrative for those folks to remain involved does have to then involve Trump, I think, to keep them engaged in any way that they've been engaged, and then to further that action. You have to continue to hammer home, Trump was not an aberration. Trump was a natural result of American history. We can repeat this. It is possible. And so that's the only way to move anything with regards to the actual like policy level and politics on the ground, is to construct that narrative and use the Trump presidency as the looming boogeyman for them.
So in Stakes is High, you call BS on the American dream and observe that what liberal white folks call a crisis is actually the everyday condition that people like me have simply learned not to see. Now, you are able to manage depression all through your life, but you finally gave way to sadness in the last few years, and you wrote that the book, at its core, was, quote, a desperate plea for community. I want to shake loose the dread, and I know I cannot do it alone. But I also cannot do it with the American myth hanging overhead. Empires fall, nations end. What does not have to end is our commitment to one another. But first it has to begin, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, you asked, so how do we move past that? In the immediate, maybe we don't. Maybe we just use that to get people engaged, and maybe that's just the way that it has to be. I'm thinking strategically here, right? Like, maybe that's just their entry point. I mean, you know, everyone has a different one. So it's just, you know, this past summer, protests that erupted in response to the killing of George Floyd. I mean, so many good white liberals were buying their anti-racist book kits. And, you know, for me, I'm sitting there saying, like, how is it that you still need these, right? Like, how is it that you haven't gotten to that point? But you know what? Maybe that's just going to be their entryway. That's going to be the thing. And so if in the first 6 months to a year of a Joe Biden presidency, I mean, fingers crossed that that comes to pass, maybe you still have to use Trump. Then it's time to say, like, we have to move past that. We have to construct it. And honestly, it's not even a construction of a narrative about America's past as much as it is a narrative about our future and asking that we commit to uprooting those past sins, uprooting those ideologies, and saying that what we once have been, we don't have to continue to be. How do we get to that point? I think that takes so much unlearning, and it takes so much organizing. It takes so much of a desire for people to get in the door in the first place. So yeah, I mean, it's tricky. It seems like long work. And again, I say we don't have much time. So we have to accelerate it in some ways, of course. I don't know that right now I'm sounding so hopeful that it could come to pass. But I just, you know, my thing is use what you got, meet people where they are. I think that's just a crucial, crucial thing, meeting people where they are and bringing them along as best you can with whatever tools you have in front of you.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Michael Denzel Smith is the author of Stakes is High, After the American Dream.
Michael was actually the last interview of the three-hour show. But just before we were ready to take a bow, Bob and Brooke answered some audience questions.
A question posed by Ben Holland. How can you have a conversation with people who live in different realities? I am genuinely curious about this.
The different realities question, I do know from everything that we've read, because we do live in our bubbles, that people can emerge if they are able to be treated with a certain amount of dignity. That doesn't mean agree with them or even think they have a point or compromising your own values or any of that stuff. But mockery has not been a friend to this process. Is it possible to acknowledge someone's pain and resentment without in any way embracing the cause? Maybe that requires us to be better than we are.
I have an answer as well, and it comes with a bit of a confession. You know, as you know, I've been working for the last several years in the democracy space on a project called the Purple Project for Democracy. And there is a subset of the democracy movement, which is all about civil dialogue, about reaching across the aisle, about having conversations with people with whom we might disagree. Everything that we were taught is the essence of American democracy, being able to look at your fellow citizen, even though you have a completely different perspective, and talk it through. And my confession, which is a very unjournalistic confession to make, is that in the past 4+ years, I've largely lost interest in that process. I've largely lost interest in trying to understand or empathize with those whose the expressions of whatever it is they've got going on in their lives is based on superstition or hoaxes or hate, on disinformation, on insane pseudo-ideologies like QAnon. I am not interested in engaging, and I'm interested in discussing the underlying issues, but I've lost any interest in trying to find common ground where the only thing between us and them is quicksand.
This goes back to the argument that we had 4 years ago, which relates to the question 4 years later, how do Brooke and Bob feel about Bob's ship of fools comment on the 2016 election morning after production meeting? And I feel that my position, maybe I didn't express it well, has been misunderstood. My point was to try and figure out how Josh Levenger sent us a question simply, why? I want to understand. It's a puzzle, except that as we've gone through the last 4 years, we understand how the kind of media that is in place has created a place where the bubbles have become impenetrable titanium spheres. And there are other reasons, but I am still obsessed with not finding common ground, but I want to understand why. Otherwise, I fear we are consigned to the same nightmare of hatred and potential violence and people living in fantasies that encroach on other people's safety, even if the presidency and the Senate were to flip. That still leaves us in the position we were in many ways before it went this way. I don't see a way to make this nation anywhere resembling what its myth of itself is, unless we understand what went wrong.
I want to address an even more specific question from Ian Depew, who says, how depressed is Bob by the fact that Trump is even still in the running at this point in the evening at 11:01 on Election Day 2020. You talked about Ship of Fools. What I was trying in my anguish to say that day 4 years ago was that I believed that we were headed as the media and as a society into a future, which I imagined is a fascistic future, that all of the signs were for something horrendous to happen. Here we are in an election that is not going to end with a landslide. And the difference is we have had 4 years after that ship has docked. So we've been 4 years here after getting off of that ship. And we can no longer say that we simply didn't understand the implications or that we couldn't see a future so dark because, after all, how could we? No, we're 4 years into this, and I can't explain. I can't understand. All that I know is everything that I believed to my core about our society turned out to be wrong.
And if I can just add a postscript, that's the good thing about the last 4 years. Is that we were either willfully or unconsciously ignorant of what the nation was. We know who we are now. If we are complacent now, there's no placing the blame elsewhere. It's all perfectly clear, and we have a responsibility, and that is intensified. It doesn't go away. It wouldn't go away with Biden, but it might have allowed many of us to think so. It might still allow many of us to think so. But the problems were always there, and they were horrendous. And now we know, and there's something in that.
Thanks for listening to this podcast extra and for joining us on election night on Zoom for 3 hours. Sign up for our newsletter. You can find out where at onthemedia.org, and we'll be back on Friday for the big show.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.